This past week, I've been doing a lot of interviews on Christian and secular radio stations on the Christmas Star. And that happens to me every year, but this year it says, hey, you know, I need to turn this into a witnessing opportunity. So I just want to share with you some ways that you can use the story of the Christmas Star in Matthew 2 as a tool to share with your friends and relatives. I mean, I really admire what Ross is wanting to do with his aunt and uncle. But I have found Christmas time is a wonderful opportunity to speak to unsaved relatives. Kathy and I will be meeting with unsaved relatives, and I know many of you will have the same opportunities, and there will be friends that we know too as well. So I just want to encourage you to take advantage of the season and to find creative ways that you can use this as an opportunity to share about our Creator, Lord, and Savior. So I'm going to share a little bit about how I think I was able to pull that off on some of these secular radio stations. I'll also tell you a little bit about a two-hour debate I had on the radio with the Dr. Jason Lyle. He's an astronomer. He's just been brought on staff by Answers in Genesis to promote a young Earth interpretation, and I knew that I couldn't put off debating him for very long, so we did have our debate. And I want to share with you a little bit about what I think is one of the most remarkable examples, at least in my opinion, of convergent evolution. It was published in this latest issue of Science, and it has to do with corvids. Those are, you know, crows, ravens, and jays, that kind of thing. By the way, if you didn't get this last week, I'm going to distribute this again. This is just a list of what I think are 12 really neat scientific discoveries of the year 2004 that give additional weight of evidence for the Christian faith. If you want to read more about this stuff, you'll see paragraph plus descriptions on our website under a thing called Today's New Reason to Believe. These are condensed to one sentence. And again, if you can use this to stimulate some kind of discussion during this Christmas time, feel free to use it. So if we can get that sent around, I sent it around last week. If you didn't get it or you want another copy, feel free to take advantage of that. In terms of this Dr. Jason Lyle, you know, he's part of Answers in Genesis, what's called Operation Refuting Compromise, which is basically targeting getting rid of Reasons to Believe and all the people that work for Reasons to Believe, including myself. We've chosen to do everything we can this year to ignore Operation Refuting Compromise. We feel we have more positive things to focus on than just responding to all these attacks from the young Earth creationist community. But recently, Answers in Genesis did hire this astronomer. He's got a PhD in astronomy from the University of Colorado, and he did his thesis on solar granulation. Now, I know of only two astronomers in the young Earth creationist camp. Jason Lyle has one. The other one would be Danny Faulkner. And Danny Faulkner is a stellar astronomer, which means he focuses on stars that are relatively close to the solar system and solar system physics. And I do find it interesting that the young Earth creationists have not been able to recruit any extragalactic astronomers or cosmologists. And indeed, if you've been following the court cases, you'll notice that in Ohio and Georgia and Kansas, the younger creationists, in attempting to get their curriculum taught in the public school system, has put through or attempted to put through legislation that would simply make it optional for public school students to be exposed to any astronomy that would take you beyond the limits of the solar system. And the point there is, once you get beyond the limits of the solar system is when you run into the most profound challenges to the young Earth paradigm. So I did find it interesting that Jason Lyle's focus is on the sun, and he's probably more correct to refer to him as a solar physicist than an astronomer. Now, I only had like about a two-hour notice of this debate that was on a radio station in Colorado Springs, a very popular radio station. Dr. Bob Grant there, who is a PhD in psychology, runs this program. It's one of the more popular radio programs around. And he had me on to talk about the Christmas Star, about 10 days ago. And, you know, Colorado Springs is kind of a Christian enclave. and it really is dominated by young Earth creationists. And we took phone calls about the Christmas star, but a lot of the people who called in were young Earth creationists wanting to take me to task. And there was one gentleman who said to Dr. Bob Grant that he was furious that I was on his show, and that he needed to bring on a scientist from Answers in Genesis to put me in my place. That was his words. So, and that's exactly what happened. Dr. Bob Grant got all kinds of letters and phone calls demanding that that be done. But one thing I do appreciate Dr. Bob Grant is he said that I wasn't going to have these people come on without you being there to face them. And so in that sense, I thought, well, this could be in the wind. But I got a phone call about 2 hours before the debate asking me if I would do it. And I felt there was no way I could duck it. This is something I had to do. This is their astronomer. And so we talked. And it was a two-hour debate on the radio. And there weren't as many ads as you would get on, say, a KKLA. So we actually had quite a bit of time to talk about the issues. And my wife, Kathy, was right. She says, Hugh, I predict that Jason Wild's strategy will be to avoid the science at all costs and focus on the Bible. And indeed, that was a strategy. And he basically had two points to make. His point was the Bible proves that the earth is young, and it does it because the days in Genesis 1 can't be anything else but 24-hour periods. And number two, death before Adam is something that God wouldn't do, and therefore we're looking at a young universe rather than an old universe where we would have the death of plants and animals going on for billions of years before God creates Adam and Eve. 10 people called in during our two-hour debate. All 10 were young Earth creationists. There's not that many here per capita, but I've noticed whenever I do anything in Colorado Springs, that's virtually the only people. Maybe there are some old Earth creationists there. I know there are because we have a chapter there, and we have a strong chapter there. But all 10 people that called in were young Earth creationists. Although 2 of the 10... did agree with a statement that I made, because I tried to kind of set the stage at the beginning because I was worried this could get hostile, and I said we need to realize that what's important about creation in the Bible is who does the creating and how he creates. When he creates has no bearing on salvation theology or biblical inerrancy. And 2 of the younger creationists that called in actually agreed with me on that point. So that led into an interesting discussion because Jason Lyle wound up saying that, he agreed that the age of the earth is, quote, not a salvation issue, but insisted it was foundational to salvation issues. To me, that sounded like a contradiction. And, I asked him to explain himself, but he chose to change the subject. So, by the way, that wasn't the only time that he contradicted himself. He also made the comment that, because I made the comment quite frequently, one caller called in and asked me, well, couldn't God simply create with the appearance of age? Because he was saying, it seems to me you're both astronomers, and astronomy rather pointedly testifies to an old universe. How about God creating with appearance of age? And I said, well, there's lots in the Bible that would tell us that that's not the way God would do it. 8 times it tells us in the Bible that God can't lie or deceive, and if he creates with appearance of age, wouldn't that be deception? And doesn't the Bible also say that the heavens declare the truth about God, that it's a truthful revelation? Psalm 19 verse 4 actually says that the record of nature are God's words written upon the heavens for all of us to read. And Jason Lyle actually agreed with that and then kind of contradicted himself. This is what he actually said. He said, well, I would agree that God does not create with appearance of age. Rather, what he does is he creates things in a mature state. Well, to me, that's the same thing. What's the difference? So I was having to deal with a lot of doublespeak, if you know what I mean, in debating him. But I just want to share with you, I'm not going to go through the whole thing here, but one point that may be of interest here to the class is the discussion we had on Job 38. Because there was one caller that called in and said, well, Dr. Ross, don't you realize that Genesis 1 tells us that the sun wasn't created till the fourth day? And the sun and the stars weren't created till the fourth day. then, you know, how would any life be kept alive? And I said, well, you know, we need to understand that there are other creation accounts in the Bible besides Genesis 1. And in fact, there are three creation accounts that actually describe events on all of the six creation days: Proverbs 8, Psalm 104, and Job 38. And I said, Job 38 in particular, verse 9, actually tells us that what was going on creation day 1 was God removing this cloud layer that wrapped the oceans in darkness and transformed that cloud layer into one that was translucent, that would light, let light pass through. Therefore, the sun, moon, and stars existed before the 6 days, but the light did not become available on the surface of the earth until day 1, and the objects weren't visible as distinct objects in the sky to life on the surface of the earth until day 4. And I said, you look at the text, it says, let there be light, and the 4th day it says, let there be the great light. But immediately took the caller to Job 38:9, where, you know, I'll just start in verse 8, who shut up the sea behind doors when it burst forth from the womb, when I made the clouds its garment and wrapped it, namely the ocean, in thick darkness, when I fixed limits for it. So I think Job 38:9 is quite clear in saying that in the beginning there was this ocean covering the whole surface of the earth, and God had wrapped that ocean in darkness and did it through a cloud layer. And therefore the first creation day is God transforming that cloud layer from an opaque state to a translucent state. Well, having said all that, Dr. Bob Grant immediately went to Jason Lyle and said, Jason, do you have a response? And he said, well, I need to look that verse up. And so he went to an ad break. So he was, I could hear him paging through trying to find Job 38:9. And then after the ad break, Dr. Bob Grant came back again and said, well, are you ready to answer the question? He said, no, not yet. So we went on to something else. And about 15 minutes later, Bob Grant said, well, are you ready now to talk about Job 38:9? And the response was really interesting. Rather than trying to give his interpretation of Job 38, he simply said, well, this is a poetic passage. It's metaphorical. It's not to be taken literal. It's got nothing to do with Genesis chapter 1. Well, those of you who've been with us in the class, we've actually gone through the text, recognize that it actually addresses the content of each of the six creation days and addresses it repeatedly. You know, it's a different style. So I did agree with Jason Lyle. Yes, it's poetry, and it's structured differently, but that I feel compelled to take its science content literally rather than metaphorically, and likewise with Psalm 104 and Job 38. Well, he kept insisting throughout the debate, Dr. Ross, you're wrong, this is not literal, this is metaphorical, it's got nothing to do with what Genesis 1 is talking about, which I think is kind of an interesting irony, because he started the interview off by saying, well, the problem with Dr. Ross and Reasons to Believe is they don't take Genesis literally. They take it figuratively. You know, I refuted that and said, well, there are actually several different literal interpretations of the text, and we need to put those different literal interpretations to the test. But, you know, he was kind of caught. And, you know, I do admire Jason Lyle in one sense, is that he spotted the problem. Because, you know, he took enough time to look at Job 38:9 to realize if he did take it literally, like we do at Reasons to Believe, then he is stuck. And not wanting to be stuck and abandon his young earth interpretation, he said, well, this is not literal. This is figurative language. So at least he was smart enough to kind of work that all the way through and figure out the situation. Yes. Yes, I mean, you could argue that it's beautiful prose, but it's written in a poetic style. So,
well, the whole sequence and the way it's all structured.
Right, there's an incredible parallelism that's going on there. And it actually takes you through the days 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. What we notice here in Job 38 is it jumps around. He'll start off with creation day 1, then jump to 2 and 3, then goes back to 1. And, you know, poetry does that. At least Hebrew poetry does. There was a hand somewhere over here. No? Okay. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, it is true that when we go through Job 38, there is metaphorical language there. I would argue you're going to find some in Genesis 1 too. And but what you do is you look at it, and you know, my rule of thumb for interpretation, you take it literally unless there's something in the context that forces a metaphorical or a figurative interpretation. Usually the Bible is pretty clear in indicating where it's metaphorical or figurative. You know, people say, well, this is symbolic. My rule of thumb there is I do not take it as symbolic unless the symbol is defined in the Bible. So I'm very uncomfortable with, say, Hal Lindsey saying that the locusts in Revelation 9 are helicopters, because I can't find anywhere in the Bible where it says locusts equals helicopters. But I do find some verses in the Bible, particularly Joel, that says locusts are demons. And therefore, if you wanted to suggest the interpretation that the locusts in Revelation 9 are demons, I'd certainly be willing to entertain that, because there at least you've got a definition within the text, the whole of the Bible, that would support that. Well, also, you need to realize that it could be both literal and figurative. And this is something that Gleason Archer and I established when we did the Genesis debate book, where we debated three different views and we defended the day-age interpretation. You notice that we were not discounting out of hand the framework hypothesis people who said, well, Genesis 1 is a metaphor for a heavenly creation, or a creation to come. And I'm prepared to accept that. However, I would disagree with the framework hypothesis people in saying that that's all Genesis 1 is teaching. So I would say the Genesis 1 text is explicitly talking about a literal creation that God established in the past to prepare this planet for human beings. But I'm prepared to concede the point to the framework hypothesis people that there is an additional message in the text beyond just what we see in terms of the literal creation of the past of the universe to prepare this planet for us. However, what I did say in the Genesis debate book is that it's difficult to pull that out of Genesis 1 by itself. I mean, from my perspective, that's the creation accounts in the New Testament that would support the idea that Genesis 1 could have an added message of pointing us to a future creation that God will perform. But to try to pull it out of Genesis 1 all by itself, there just isn't adequate metaphorical signals in the text to force that interpretation as the primary interpretation. It could be a secondary interpretation, but not the primary one. Likewise with Job 38, I see lots of opportunities here. In fact, we discussed them in the class about how we can take this text figuratively and metaphorically. But I would argue that this is not the primary message of the text. The primary one is one that could be taken literally. It's God. In fact, that's what I said to Jason Lyle. I said, look at the context of Job 38 before you draw your conclusion that this isn't literal. This is the first time the Lord speaks after a long debate amongst these five ancient scientists about creation and creation and God. And then God steps in and basically gives these five gentlemen a creation test. And says, don't you think the creation test is meant to be taken literally? I mean, here are questions. I mean, I would hate to go into an exam room where a professor gives me a test on, say, physics and say, oh, this is all figurative. And, you know, answer the questions in that context, I would flunk. Now, there may be some figurative application, but what's the primary context here? And it's God talking to these five men about his creation, and therefore we should take that literally. So, however, as I say, I compliment Jason Lyle for figuring it out, that if he did take it literally, then his interpretation of Genesis 1 would fail, and not wanting to do that, he took the position of saying it can't be literal. Yes?
Quite regularly, literary and metaphorical language that speaks to prophets in a parable, in order to say, oh, this is literary and metaphorical, what you're trying to say. That's how much the Bible
true, but notice that when Jesus did speak in parables, there was plenty in the text to indicate this is a parable. Right, right. That's my whole point. There will always be clues in the text on how we should take the primary message of the text. And so in terms of Job 38, that's missing. Now, I'm always a believer in saying that you can take any chapter of the Bible and preach about six different sermons or more out of that chapter, because God's giving us a very compact book. He intends that we would be able to get multiple applications and messages out of the single text. A lot of the prophecies in the Bible are double or triple in their context. So just realizing that God's trying to give us a book that's not multiple volumes, we should take that into account. However, there's always a primary message. Okay, in the back. Well, Jason Lyle actually raised that point out of Genesis 2, where he says, well, you know, God put Adam in this garden, and the garden was already mature. But if you read the text carefully, it says he planted this garden and allowed the trees to grow. So it indicates that it wasn't something that God just snapped his fingers and there it was. But not until it was grown and set up in the state that God intended did he place Adam in the garden. And you see that in the text too. Adam was not created in the garden. He was placed into the garden. And therefore, exactly what maturation process is going on, how much time was taking place, I don't know. But the idea that allowing the trees to grow is significant. Incidentally, that's a point that Gleason Archer provided for me in the book The Genesis Debate. And that's something he thinks is a strong argument against the appearance of age. Yes. Right, well, I expected Jason Lyle to raise that argument about the stature and the capability of Adam. He did not, mainly because he's probably read what I've written on that. And, the point there being is that the height of Adam would only be an appearance of age if you had said, well, he came out of the womb of a woman. But Adam and Eve are the exceptions. They're the only two people that did not come out of the womb of a woman. And only if they came out of the womb of a woman would they have, quote, appearance of age. But God creating them from the dust of the earth, he could have created them brand new, 6 feet tall, or he could have created them brand new, 18 inches tall. He chose to create them 6 feet tall. And what I've said in my writings is that if there was a scientist around to measure the age of Adam when God had created him, he would measure 0 days old. I would not expect to find a lot of liver spots on his skin, for example, as I'm sure all of you. I mean, even the young ones that are here in the class, even the children, if you look carefully at their skin, you will find liver spots. And the older you get, the easier it is to find those liver spots. Don't look too carefully at me, okay? Yeah, you will find lots of liver spots. So scar tissue, chipped teeth, worn teeth, I don't believe any of that evidence would have been present in Adam. My younger creationist friends often dispute that with me, but I say, well, guess what? That evidence simply isn't available to us. So you cannot argue a case on this. It's pure speculation. But I would argue it's not quite pure speculation because of what the rest of the Bible says. God does not lie. He does not deceive. And what he creates in nature is meant to be a trustworthy and reliable record of what he has done. So, by the way, I'm going to have to talk about that issue of appearance of age when we have the leaders of the Young Earth and Old Earth community assembled in March at Dallas Theological Seminary. So appreciate your prayers for that. By the way, we did record the whole debate, and we're still applying for permission to make that available. So if it is, I'll let you know. Otherwise, what I told you this morning will have to suffice. But if you want to hear it word for word, we are letting our staff listen to it. So if you really want to hear it, you can come to our staff, but you're not allowed to distribute it, at least until we get permission. Yeah. The Christmas Star article is on our website, although I'm thinking of rewriting it in light of my experiences this week. And if there's no more questions, I'll jump right into the Christmas Star. Yes?
Do you know why God created man?
Why did he create man, Bertrand? I know there's a joke coming here. Tell me, why did he create man? Are you just being serious? Oh, you're being serious. All right. Well, it's something we discussed in our Message of the Month series that we recorded in 2004, namely the problem of evil. That one of the reasons why God created man, there are other reasons, but one reason was to use the human species as a part of God's vehicle for bringing about a complete, permanent conquest of the problem of evil. Jesus and Paul talked about this, saying, don't you realize that you who are followers of Jesus Christ are being prepared by God to be rulers and teachers in the kingdom of heaven, in the new creation, and that we'll be rulers and judges and teachers even over the angels. So there's a preparation we're going through. And we are the only spirit species that God created in this universe, but because we're the only spirit species, we can be uniquely used by God to bring about this conquest of evil. To be part of that. So, but I'll tell you to go to the Message of the Month series. You want to see something in writing on that? There's a book over there called Beyond the Cosmos. Okay, Christmas Star. And, what I'm finding is that, even the most atheistic talk show hosts are willing to bring on an astronomer at Christmas time to talk about the Christmas Star, and they give you a fair amount of freedom. So I decided I was going to push it a little more than I have in years past. And, they always like to say, well, doesn't the Bible tell us that these wise men were astrologers? And I says, well, that is a possible interpretation of the Greek word magos. And what I do is actually give them the lexical definition. If you're interested, the first definition given in all the lexicons is Oriental or Eastern scientist, a scientist of the East. Wise men is the second definition. Astrologer and seer are definitions 3 and 4. So it is true that if you look it up in the lexicon, the word astrologer shows up there. Now, this term wise men is something that you also find in the book of Daniel. And Daniel was the chief of the wise men of Nebuchadnezzar's court. Likewise, the chief of the wise men for the Persian kings that took over. And it tells us that he was taught in all the sciences and disciplines of the East. And so that would have included astrology, but it would have included biology, botany, would have included astronomy, chemistry, physics, literally all the knowledge, history, geography, would have been included. So I think the best way to consider these wise men, these the magos, is that these were individuals who were very well educated in all the academic disciplines of the East. And certainly they would have been well aware of what's going up in the sky. Now, what we do note, and what I did get to share, is that one of the special things about the wise men is that they probably would have had high regard for Daniel. Daniel being the chief of the wise men for both the Babylonians and the Persians, I can't see how any educated Eastern scientist could avoid being exposed to the Book of Daniel. And the interesting thing about the Book of Daniel, it's the only book in the Old Testament that predicts the timing of the coming of the Messiah. And it's in Daniel chapter 9. And what it tells us in Daniel 9 says, know and understand this, verse 25. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one, the ruler, comes, there will be 7 sevens and 62 sevens. It, referring to Jerusalem, will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but in times of trouble. After the 62 sevens, the anointed one will be cut off and will have nothing. The people of the ruler who will come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. War will continue to the end, and desolations have been decreed. He will confirm a covenant with many for 1 7, but in the middle of that seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering, and one who causes desolation will place abominations on a wing of the temple until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. Now, going back to verse 25, it's laying out the seven sevens and 62 sevens. And you say, what on earth is a seven? Well, if you go back to Daniel 4:23, remember we were talking earlier, there are symbols in the Bible, but every symbol is defined in the Bible. And here Daniel is using a symbol. What is the seven? Well, Daniel 4:23 defines what the seven is. 1 7 equals 7 years. Because you go back to Daniel 4, it's referring to the story of Nebuchadnezzar, and Nebuchadnezzar was insane for 7 years and refers to that period of insanity as 1 7. So you can use that as a formula, and that basically means that there will be 483 years between the signing of this decree by the Persian kings to rebuild the city of Jerusalem and the coming of the Anointed One. And so that's what these wise men would have known. And they would have certainly have known the date of the signing of that decree. They would have added 483 years, and that would have told them the approximate timing of the coming of the Messiah. Now, it would be approximate because this is what makes Bible prophecy difficult. If you look in the Persian historical records, there were three decrees that they signed with the Jewish captives to rebuild the city of Jerusalem. One was for starting the foundation, one was for completing the city, and the third one was for building the temple. And so the big problem here is, well, which decree do you use to count your 483 years? And, you know, I've known Bible teachers who say Daniel 9 gives you the exact time of the coming of the Messiah, because they look at it as 483.0000 years, and so they take the date of the decree, they count off exactly 483 years, and the rumor is that's how they came up with December 25th, by doing that. However, I'm more comfortable with taking the point, look, there are three decrees, and they're spaced over just a few-year period, and therefore I think what these wise men, these Oriental scientists, would have done is during that window of 2 or 3 years, they would have been watching the sky, looking for a sign, because they didn't know which decree the text was referring to, and therefore I think they would have looked at all three numbers. So rather than giving them the exact day, it simply gave them an approximate time. And this is the need for the star. They only knew the approximate time, so they used the star as an indication of the exact time. Now, on all these secular radio stations, the big debate is, what is a star? That's what they all want to talk about. They figure, you're an astronomer, tell us what the star is. Well, I've got a whole collection in my office of books written by astronomers, and what I find amusing is it's usually atheist astronomers who write books about the Christmas star. I've only got one book that's written by an astronomer who's a believer, and I'm not even sure he's evangelical. Everything else is written by atheists. And we're talking more than a dozen books. But what they all say is that it's a conjunction of planets. And frankly, I don't think that's a very good explanation for the Christmas star. And what they mean by a conjunction of planets, I don't know how many of you get up early, but about 6 weeks ago, there was a gorgeous conjunction of Venus and Jupiter in the early morning sky, where they came close together. And the interpretation is that if two bright planets come close together in the sky, and they come close enough together that they merge and look like one star, wouldn't that be a really spectacular event? And I would argue, yes, it would. But the problem is that astronomers can actually go back using the present orbits of the planets and calculate just how spectacular all the conjunctions were at the time of the birth of Jesus. And the best that we find is about a moon diameter and a half. And, you know, that's not very good. You'll see a conjunction of planets like that about once or twice a year. And the eyesight of people at that time wasn't that bad. We know that anyone who could split a couple of stars at the second from the end of the handle of the Big Dipper was automatically into the Roman army. And those two stars are separated by 1/6 of the moon diameter. So it was fairly routine for people that time to be able to distinguish stars that close together. And there are no conjunctions where the planets come closer than 1/6 of a moon diameter. A moon diameter is about the best you get. And that happens, as I said, once or twice a year. That's simply not spectacular enough that these scientists would see that as a sign. Well, a couple of books I got actually make note of that and say, well, it must have been a supernova. But if you read the Matthew 2 text carefully, what you notice, let me just take you to the text there. It's kind of interesting what it does say. It says, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod Magi. By the way, I got to read this in one of my interviews because I had no clue what the Bible said about it, so we looked at it. And he was disputing my statement that the text actually says the star appears twice with a separation of nearly 2 years. Now, if you read this, you can see it's very explicit in stating that's exactly what happened. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." Critical thing here, these books I've got and also these talk show hosts all feel, and this is, I think, promulgated by our culture, that the star actually was kind of like a searchlight or a flashlight that pointed the Magi right to the stable where Jesus was born. Well, notice it didn't tell them the location. They went to Jerusalem, as it says here, to find out where this King of the Jews. They didn't know where. The star simply told them the time. It did not tell them the place. When King Herod heard of this, he was disturbed and all Jerusalem with him. And note there that it's probably not like this tie where you have the three wise men and three camels. My guess is that in order to throw the entire city and King Herod into a stir, and this would have been a city of about 30,000 people, to throw a city of that size into a stir, we're probably looking at an entourage of 50 to 100 people with these kings. All we know is it's three gifts. We don't know the number of the kings. We only know the number of the gifts. And therefore, I think it was quite a large entourage. And then, when he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, and the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel." And by the way, what I did in a couple of these shows is read what else Micah says right thereafter. Because right after Micah 5:2, it talks about the second coming of the Messiah, just like Daniel 9 talks about both comings of the Messiah. So I find it interesting that both Micah 5 and Daniel 9 talk about both comings of the Messiah. So there's some verses here for us. "Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared." So King Herod knew the precise time, and that was identified with the birth of this king. "He sent them to Bethlehem and said, 'Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him.' And after they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed." Point there being, they saw the star in the east, it disappeared, and now it reappeared as they were on their way to the small village of Jerusalem. Bethlehem, pardon me. "On coming to the house," doesn't say manger, does it? Doesn't say stable. It says, "On coming to the house." So there's a real good clue. This is not the manger scene. This is quite a bit of a period of time thereafter. Now we have Mary and Joseph and Jesus living in a house. "They saw the child with his mother Mary." Evidently Joseph wasn't there at the time. "And they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented them him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. Get up, he said, take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you, for Herod is going to search for the child to kill him. And so he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt. Evidently, he left immediately after the dream. Didn't wait. Got Mary and Jesus up out of their sleep and said, we're taking off now. We're not going to mess around. So he got up and took the child and his mother during the night and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said to the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. When Herod realized he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious and gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Therefore, the Magi told them the coming or the timing of the star that they had seen in the east, and he used that time between their arrival and when they saw the star in the east to figure out he's going to need to kill these boys 2 years of old and under. So that tells us that there's at least a year and a half between the first appearance of the star and the second appearance of the star, and it could be as much as 2 years. By the way, Herod went overboard. If he had known the Bible carefully, he would have realized this would have had to have been a firstborn son, and he would have only killed the firstborn sons 2 years of age and under. But the text tells us he killed all the boys that were 2 years of old and under. Yes. Well, there was Quirinius is mentioned in the Luke text, and that was a name that was not well established by archaeology and just until the last 15 years, and the dates for that taxation are not clear. That's one of the reasons why we can only pin down the birth of Jesus to about a plus or minus 2 year window. So. Well, if you read the Luke text, it tells us that Joseph had to return to his place of birth, and this would have been Bethlehem, and so he was living in another part of Israel at the time, but because of this taxation, you had to go to a particular, quote, polling booth, and so he had to go down to Bethlehem, and then with this newborn child, he decided to stay. He may have stayed with relatives, he may have had friends there, who knows, but he did stay. And then warned in a dream to go to Egypt. So that's the reason why he went to Bethlehem, you know, because everybody had to go back to their place of origin. And so the entire Jewish population would have been migrating all over the place to pay their taxes. Right. Okay. So what I've been writing about, and this is the paper, it's up on our web. You can download it. You can print it. You can call our office, and we'll get you a copy, is that of the word for star that's used in the text, aster, I don't think can be used for the Shekinah glory. That's been a common Christian interpretation, that it wasn't a star at all. It wasn't a planet. Wasn't a comet, but was the Shekinah glory. But the word star has never been used for anything other than an object in the sky. So I'm comfortable saying it's kind of glory. It's not an impossible interpretation, but I would argue it's a difficult interpretation. Why use the word aster if that indeed is what's going on? But one of the reasons why some Christians have said it's the Shekinah glory, because if it's the Shekinah glory, then it's God's divine flashlight pointing you right to the home. A 20 months old or 22 months old. that would be fairly easy to figure out. So they don't need the star or the light to point them to the actual location. Now, the word can mean comet, asteroid, meteor, star, planet, galaxy, anything like that, any bright thing in the sky would qualify. My favorite interpretation is that this is a recurring nova. The supernova explanation to me does not work because, number one, it's too bright. Supernova are recorded by everybody back for thousands of years. The astronomers of that time did not miss recording supernova in their records. However, nobody was recording nova. And so these wise men may have been the only ones that have spotted this nova. And keep in mind, this is the only historical record of this event. There is no other record. And a recurring nova, there are stars that will go... By the way, what's a nova? It's a star that explodes and becomes several thousand times brighter than normal. A supernova is a star that explodes and becomes billions of times brighter than normal. And in fact, when a supernova explodes in our galaxy, you can usually see it in the daytime. A nova is something that might appear, say, as bright as a North Star. But for wise men watching the sky, they would have spotted this. You say, how frequently does this occur? Well, something as bright as, say, the North Star showing up in a constellation somewhere in the sky, that happens about every 40 years, every 40 to 50 years. So that would have been unusual enough to catch their attention. And then there is a small class of nova, about 5%, that are called recurring nova, where they explode, they disappear, and then they re-explode. You say, how does that work? Well, it's because there's a partner star orbiting around the nova star. And the nova star steals gas and material from the partner star. And it steals enough of this gas that it winds up going through a nova explosion. And then that subsides, but the star still keeps pulling gas off the partner star. And when it accumulates enough gas, it goes through another explosion. So what's the time separation? Anywhere from 1 to 50 years between eruptions. So a two-year period would be, that's actually the most common period of eruption for recurring nova. Can we find anything in the sky that would fit? No, we can't. Not thousands of years later. Yes. Well, from the time of King David up through to 100 years after the birth of Christ, the population varied from 100 to a high of 5,000. Most Bible scholars put it in the neighborhood of 1,000 at this time. It might have been smaller. Doubtful it was much larger than 1,000. 1,000 is on the generous side. It'd still be easy to find a couple with a 22-month-old firstborn son in a village of 1,000 people or less. That wouldn't be difficult, especially if you had 50 to 100 people going door to door. You'd be able to pick that out quite easily. So, yes. Yeah, the Greek word is systeme. No, okay, aster is the word star. I thought you were talking about the word for stood over. Because that's another problem. People read the English translation and say, doesn't the text actually say that the star pointed to the exact location? Well, as an astronomer, I can tell you there's nothing like a comet or an asteroid or a star or a planet that's going to point you to a particular location on planet Earth. After all, the Earth rotates. And so the position of anything in the sky is going to move as the clock goes. So there's no way an astronomical object is going to point you to the location. And actually, if you look up the definition for the word histeme, let me just read it for you. This is straight out of the lexicon. To cause or make to stand, to appoint, to place, to put, to set, to make firm, to fix, to establish, to cause something or someone to keep its place, or to sustain something. The point there being that it has such a broad definition that to interpret it as definitively saying it actually pointed the location is taking the definition beyond. I mean, it's a very broad term. You can translate it a whole variety of ways. That does not have to be translated as we see it here in most English translations. but you got to come up with something, so that's what they put in there. So it's not guiding to a particular geographical location. Okay, any more questions on this? By the way, what I try to do in all these interviews that work really well, and I want to encourage you to do this at Christmas time, because I've always found that this is a great way to get into spiritual discussions at Christmas time, is to make the point. Here we go. It's histeme. Same word. Yeah, I mean, what happens is that most English translations will give you a fairly broad phrase for that single word in the Greek. But yeah, that whole phrase, it's just the word histeme. So, yes. Persists would work. It showed up. So that would be good enough. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, there are people who speculate these wise men were Zoroastrians. And I don't know about whether or not Daniel had any input in instructing Zoroaster. People have speculated that, but I don't know of any documentation that proves that. In either case, Zoroaster is not a true prophet of God. He's a false prophet. But yeah, it's popular for many people to think of these people as not followers of God, but rather simply occult scientists. But the thing I think is remarkable is that the only way they could have been watching the sky this carefully is if they knew the prophecy of Daniel. And they must have had very high regard for Daniel, because look at the money and time they invested in this journey. Frankly, I don't think they could be anything other than believers in the one true God of Daniel to have that kind of faith, to spend that much time and that much money and laying these gifts at the feet of the anointed one that Daniel had predicted. So I don't buy the idea that they were simply occult scientists. I think they were admirers of Daniel and were believers in the God that Daniel preached. Now, they probably only had that one book of the Bible, and therefore they would have been ignorant of everything else that would pertain to a true follower of God in terms of written revelation. But I'm prepared to forgive them that. And notice this too. They went to the priests to get additional information. That to me also testifies to their faith and their belief in the one true God. Otherwise, why would they go to Jerusalem to inquire of the priesthood of the people of Daniel? So anyway, that's just my take on it. Yeah, it could be. Well, also, Kennedy has been promoting this idea that the gospel is written in the stars, which is something that I think is completely bogus. I mean, all you got to do is look up at the sky, and you know what you'll see in James Kennedy's writings. And by the way, he's simply quoting from a book called The Gospel and the Stars, written by a Christian. I've got the book. And frankly, what I think this gentleman is doing is reading into the constellations a gospel message that's very difficult to read into those star patterns. I mean, when I look up at the stars and, you know, see what the astrologers claim those patterns mean, it's a huge stretch. And, you know, having done a little bit of study in that myself, what I understand is that these ancient astrologers had the story they wanted to tell, so they looked up at the sky and found the best patterns in the sky that would fit their story. And so you look up at the sky, and they talk about Cassiopeia, a woman that's sitting on a throne. When you look up at the sky, all I see is a big W. I don't see the woman, and the W doesn't look much like a chair to me, but I would agree that that's probably the best thing you're going to find in the sky that looks like a woman sitting on a chair. So that's what they went with. But what James Kennedy is talking about is that there was this corrupted message that the astrologers used to tell their story, but there is an original true story. and he uses verses like the heavens declare the glory of God. However, the Bible tells us very clearly not to look to the patterns of the stars for spiritual truth. So the fact that we, and by the way, I've got a paper on astrology that's up on our reasons.org website, and you'll see, I quote there verses in the Bible that tell us to stay away from astrology, and tell us that's a sin that will get you into contact with demons if you pursue it very deeply. So I think that's enough to put to rest the idea that these wise men were unbelievers. I think they were really believers. In fact, what I did in these secular radio shows was to make the point, we today should emulate the faith of these wise men. You know, this is a special time, and we should be watching too. And there's two points I made. My time is getting short here. I thought I was going to talk about all this other stuff too. We'll see. two applications. God sent Christ at the best time to be a baby, live among us, to live a life of righteousness, and to sacrifice himself on the cross on the behalf of our sins. It's the best time because it was the first time in human history where God could change his strategy of having the Jews stay in one place, basically at the junction of the three great continents, and share the good news about God with people that were caravanning through their territory. What we have with the coming of Jesus is a dramatic change in strategy, where God tells the followers of Jesus Christ, from now on, you go. Don't wait for the people to come to you going through your nation as a necessary caravan route joining the three great continents. Rather, you're to go to all the nations. And why that was a feasible strategy, this is the first time in history where there was a decent, safe transportation system. That's the one thing that the Romans did in the first century, as they had built this system of roads so that they could manage this huge empire with a relatively small army, because they would just have these legions and they could move from place to place quickly. And they had places where along these roads where they could get provisions. And basically what we have God doing with the followers of Jesus Christ is saying, take advantage of the Roman system. The Romans have put peace over a large area. They got this great transportation system. Use it to take the good news of Jesus Christ to all the peoples of the world. So in that sense, I would argue God sent Jesus at the best time. And these magi were watching that time, and they responded. Likewise, the disciples responded to being placed here at the best time. And then I made a second application, which is to say, you know, in the context of the entire universe, we are here at the best time. This is the only time in cosmic history when we can see all that God has done in creation. And by the way, every talk show host really got fascinated by that. I would drop that with just one sentence and just wait. There'd be a pause, and then they would jump on me. Tell me, you got to tell me what this is all about. And that was a wonderful opportunity to make the point that this is the only time in cosmic history in which human observers, or any kind of observers in the universe, can actually see the entire history of the universe from the creation event all the way forward. If we were created any earlier, radiation from the Big Bang creation event would not have adequate time to reach our telescopes. We wouldn't be able to see that evidence. And if we were created any later, dark energy in the universe, which we've been talking about in the context of Job 38:19, that dark energy would have that light moving at greater than the velocity of light, and therefore would also be invisible to us. This is the only time in cosmic history in which human observers can look out at the universe and see everything that God has done. So when the Bible says the heavens declare the glory of God, the heavens declare the righteousness of God, this time, Christmas 2004, not exactly, there's about a million year window in which you can see the Big Bang radiation, or the radiation from the Big Bang creation event. But any earlier, any later in cosmic history, it's not going to happen. And one thing you can do that's fun with your relatives is to take that million years, compare it with 13.7 billion, and say, what kind of fine-tuning are we looking at here? It really is remarkable. Okay, question. No, no, the comment made is that James Kennedy with Coral Ridge Ministries has speculated that Daniel was the teacher of Zoroaster, James Kennedy is not saying that Zoroaster was a follower of God, or that Zoroaster taught Daniel, rather the other way around. Zoroaster may have been exposed to some of what Daniel had taught and wrote. That's possible. But the idea that he was the personal disciple of Daniel, nothing to support that conclusion. Okay, there was a question here. Well, one of my favorites, it's an old book, and it's been brought back into print. It was called Science Speaks, and it was written by the chairman of the Astronomy and Physics Department at Pasadena City College back in the 40s. Went through several new editions. And now the astronomer Robert Newman has brought out a new edition of that book. It's got a different title, but we have it at our office. And Peter Stoner, the author's name, what Peter Stoner did is he went through the entire Old Testament and collected all of the prophecies about the first coming of the Messiah. And I think there's 109 of them that you can count throughout the whole of the Bible. And what he did in this book, he went through the exercise of calculating mathematically what's the probability that a man, by his own individual efforts, could self-fulfill those prophecies. And he calculated some ridiculously improbable probability and said, you know, this could not happen by human design. This would have to be something that God himself had set up thousands of years in advance. I mean, the very fact that it had to be of the tribe of Judah. Had to be a descendant of King David through both the mother's line and the father's line. There's a lot that was beyond the control of Jesus. And he said one of the most amazing things was he was, betrayed for exactly 30 pieces of silver. The prophet Zechariah said he would be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver, and those 30 pieces of silver would be used as a burial site for the poor of Jerusalem. That's exactly what happened. How can you control something that leads to your own death? And you have in Psalm 22, written by King David, where he predicts the precise words that the Jewish self-righteous leaders would say to Jesus when he was dying on the cross, and actually prophesied that his clothes would be divided up through the throwing of dice by foreigners. I mean, and that he would be pierced, that his side would be pierced. Tremendous detail. And read Psalm 22. In fact, I think that the centurion that watched Jesus die on the cross probably was a centurion that knew the content of Psalm 22. Because in the hours he was dying on the cross, dozens of prophecies in Psalm 22 are being fulfilled. But Peter Stoner is the one that says, you calculate the mathematical probability of that happening by chance, without God working it out in advance supernaturally, it's utterly remote. Therefore, this is proof that the Bible is indeed the error-free Word of God, and we need to take this message seriously. And I love the way Peter Stoner closes his book. He says, now that you've been exposed to this information, you are responsible. You're either signing your name as one willingly going to the depths of hell, or one who is signing his name to receive all the rewards and glories of the new creation. Your name is assigned on one page or the other since you've now been exposed to that. Use the theme, to him has been given much, much is expected. He says, now you've been given much. So, but Robert Newman's got the book out.
We're out of time.
We're out of time. Okay.
Go ahead and pray, and then I've got something I want
to do. Okay. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we want to pray for Ross's uncle, that, Lord, that Ross would really have a wonderful opportunity to share with him the scientific evidence for the Christian faith. And more than that, Lord, I pray that you would cause Ross and his uncle to have a really meaningful conversation about Ross's uncle's need to give his life to Christ and to receive all the benefits here and now for this new life in Jesus Christ. So open up those doors, Lord. And I pray you would do that for each one of us. Lord, as we walk away from this class, bring to mind certain unsaved friends and relatives that we're going to have contact with this Christmas season, and help us by your Spirit to develop a strategy for presenting the good news of Jesus Christ to these individuals. Father, may we come back into this class next week with many stories of how we've been used by your Spirit to be ambassadors of the life, love, and light of Jesus Christ. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.